fisherman said, you're not right. Now I'm staying up all night.
Hey friends, it's the Crow Boys. Our debut album, Made to Wonder, is out now.
Download and stream it wherever you listen to music.
Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey. After my visit to the Miller Williams Archives and busking out on the street, I took a walk around the neighborhood. I noticed that this part of Austin had a lot of new buildings, sleek and tall, like giant ice cubes. College kids were meandering out of heavy doors, pushing often against the wind. As I walked, I was thinking about what I had learned from visiting those archives. How Miller, as a parent, laid down this foundation of artistic integrity for his kids. How Lucinda witnessed America's best writers working on their craft from an early age. How childhood can inform the possibilities and the struggles we face as creative adults. But I had more questions about Lucinda. I understood a fair bit about her life as a kid by this point. But I wasn't so sure about her life when she was just getting started playing music, when she started putting herself out there as an artist. I wondered, as I walked around, what was she like when she played her first gigs? Did she have a lot of self-doubt? Was she as uncertain of her worthiness as an artist as I found myself to be? You're listening to Finding Lucinda from The Bluegrass Situation. I'm your host, Ismay. This is an audio documentary recounting a journey I took several years ago. I decided to embark on a road trip across the U.S., starting where I lived on a ranch in Northern California. I was a budding singer-songwriter. I had a lot of self-doubt and uncertainty of how to go forward with my aspirations. So I decided to look towards my musical hero, country Americana legend, Lucinda Williams. You're listening to Episode 3. Months before I came to Austin, I spoke with my friend Chuck Prophet. He said that if I was going to try to understand Lucinda Williams' early life, if I was going to answer my burning questions about self-doubt, there was a specific guy I really needed to talk to. His name, Charlie Sexton. Now, for those of you that don't know, Charlie is a big deal. Best known for being Bob Dylan's guitar player. He's also a producer and artist in his own right, and he's even been in movies. Charlie has played with the best. In fact, Charlie was probably the most well-known person I was planning on asking to interview for this entire project, and that made me really nervous. I waited for days before dialing the number my friend Chuck had given me. I punched in the buttons a couple of times before pressing call. Then it rang. There was no answer, but I left a voicemail. I fell into my cutesy, scared voice that comes up from within me whenever I'm really nervous about something. Hey, Charlie, I'm just calling. I'm a friend of Chuck's, and I'd love to talk to you about this project I've been working on about following Lucinda Williams' path. Anyways, if you're interested, just give me a call back. I'd love to chat. You can text me, of course. My number is 423-071-5. Well, Charlie called me back. Huzzah! I was elated. He was quite nice, actually. We chatted about his friendship with Lucinda for a long time. He was interested in my project. He wasn't sure, though, that he was going to be able to fit an interview into his schedule. But he was going to try. He was pretty busy with studio gigs and touring and didn't have a lot of days to spare. Months passed after we spoke over the phone. Travel dates shifted. But finally, I was heading to Austin, and Charlie and me, we had to seal the deal, so to speak. I was packing my truck up, and I asked Charlie if he'd be around when I was going to be around. And what do you know, he was going to be in Austin at the same time that I was, with a free morning to spare. So we decided to meet up at a legendary venue, the Hole in the Wall. In addition to interviewing Charlie, there was actually one more thing I was really, really hoping to do. I wanted to play a song together. I brought it up to him over the phone. He didn't say yes, and he didn't say no. I emailed him a voice memo of my cover of the song so he could prepare. It was a lesser-known song of Lucinda's, one where there was never a studio version recorded and released. The only place you could find it was on the self-titled album Deluxe Edition, a live radio session from KCRW of this song, Sundays. I had a little bit of pause at that point. Was I not good enough to play with Charlie? Did he think the voice memo that I sent was terrible? Maybe he didn't want to play a song with me and was just trying to be nice and not say it to my face. Our interview was set, and I'd made it out to Austin. And there I was, waiting to meet Charlie, standing outside the Hole in the Wall. There, that venue sat amongst those five-story glassy buildings. Hole in the Wall was just one story high. The design was unique. There were two colors, one stripe of vibrant yellow paint above one stripe of black paint, all the way around the building. The color was so bright yellow that it stung my eyes a little bit. The whole exterior of this place conveyed a sort of, I don't care what you think, punk ethos. And I appreciated that. I walked through a swingy old door from the street and arrived inside. There were almost no windows in there. You could hardly tell that it was early in the day. I sat down and ate a breakfast burrito I had brought with me. It had potatoes and eggs, my favorite. Then, to pass time, I stepped into a photo booth. I took a series of self-portraits. And as the bulb flashed in my face, I thought about a fascinating picture I'd seen before. One of the few pictures you can find of Robert Johnson that was taken in a photo booth. I pulled the curtain to the side, stepped out, and picked up my pictures. Then I stood nervously at the bar. I was worried that Charlie might not show up. I mean, I didn't really know him very well. What if he was sick or something came up? To calm my nerves, I sang a little tune to myself, the melody of the song I was hoping Charlie would play with me, Sundays. The door opened up, and bright light shone in.
Hi there.
Hey, how are you? Good to see you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Hole in the Wall.
Thanks. This is my first time here.
Really?
Yeah, I've never been here. I've been to Austin.
I looked down and saw that Charlie held something in his hand. A black guitar case. Did that mean he was ready to play a song with me? Even though we had checked in the day before, he still had not mentioned he would be up for playing that song, that voice memo I'd sent him. But that guitar in his hand, it was sitting there like Chekhov's gun. That's this idea that if there's a loaded gun on the mantle in the beginning of a story, it has to go off by the end of it. So I wondered, was that true of a guitar? If you bring a guitar to a music venue, an interview, must it be played by the end of the story?
Pretty cool.
It's been here a second.
Well, we can sit down at this table.
Yeah,
then.
Sure.
You can sit here. We got some water.
Did you give me water?
Aw,
that's so awesome.
How's your day going?
We sat down across from one another at a little square table. It was a touch wobbly. There was a Texas flag on the stage in the corner behind Charlie. Charlie's aura was kind, engaging without being domineering. I could see why so many people wanted to work with him. Charlie was cool. Combed silvery hair, layered necklaces. But Charlie was the good kind of cool guy, a nice one. I was so nervous to talk with him, laughing left and right, scared to ask if he'd play the song with me. But fortunately, Charlie put me at ease. And plus, I had a glass of water to sip every time I didn't know what to say.
That's right. So I was going to start just by like asking you about what are your first memories of Lucinda?
Well, it's funny. I don't know if you knew or you chose this location specifically, but I'd met Lou a couple times early on. But that gig, and I mentioned to you at some point, when I was like 11 years old, I did a gig with her.
Wow.
Before she was, you know, I don't even know how many gigs she'd done.
Yeah.
She was, you know, obviously doing the folk scene. Mm-hmm. But the place that we played, which was the first time I really spent any time with her, mm-hmm. was about 4 blocks away.
Wow. When you were 11?
Yeah.
And do you, like, remember how the gig went?
Oh, completely. Well, the gig was at a place that was somewhat an old legendary club that actually predated this place in a way. And it was called the Rome Inn. Mm-hmm. And it strangely just burnt down, like, a couple weeks ago. But anyway, it was a really cool place, and it had closed but then kind of reopened but not really, and Clyde, who was her, you know, I think really got her deep into all the New Orleans and Louisiana music, it was his birthday party or something, and our mutual said, hey, that's, you know, come play this show, my friend Speedy. And he drug me along. I mean, I barely could play. I was just really figuring things out. So what I remember about the gig, it was really loud from people talking. And there was no, it wasn't really a stage. They brought in something. And it was just kind of somewhat a blur. And most of that's on me because, I was just like, how does this thing work, you know?
Wow.
It was kind of the beginning.
Was she one of the first people you played with out?
No, I played a little bit around, a little bit, but that was that year was that's when I first started jumping up on stage and learning on the job, so to speak.
And like, do you remember?
The first hint of Charlie's unusual beginnings as a musician came from learning at the Hole in the Wall about how he met Lucinda. He played with her when he was just 11. I wondered, how in the world does an 11-year-old end up playing a real gig with a singer-songwriter? Well, Charlie got an early start to being a musician. His mom took him to shows starting when he was just 5. He saw performances by artists like Frank Zappa and Todd Rundgren. Charlie took to music keenly from early on, obsessed and talented. His actual first gig was when he was 10. And so, at that young age, Charlie began joining bands. He played a weekly gig with blues legend W.C. Clark. At just 13, Charlie was living on his own while his family was in a town about an hour away. Charlie joined the band of a successful local singer-songwriter, Joe Ely. So this history that Charlie recounted of playing with Lucinda when he was 11 was in about probably his first year of performing. And it was in Lucinda's early days of performing as well. After doing some research, I calculated that the year was 1979 when they played together for the first time. Lucinda would have been roughly 26 years old. And that was back when she put out her first album, mainly covers, called Ramblin' on My Mind. So it turns out that, as Chuck had told me, Charlie was exactly the person to talk to. He was there from the very early days of Lucinda's career. In fact, it might turn out that Charlie is the longest ongoing collaborator that Lucinda has had throughout her whole life. They've been playing together for 46 years. So that venue that Charlie talked about in this interview where he and Lucinda played in 1979, it was called Rome Inn, spelled like the city, R-O-M-E, and inn like a place you stay, I-N-N. The Rome Inn started out as an Italian restaurant. The owners decided they'd host a couple of live shows, and they ended up being very successful. In fact, the shows were so popular that Rome Inn almost lost their ability to operate as a restaurant because too much of their money was coming from alcohol sales. The venue developed a blues scene that became the most well-known in Austin at the time. If you look back at photographs, you'll see that Rome Inn was a low-slung building. On the inside, there was a wooden dance floor, a medium-sized stage in the corner that was placed without too much care. The ceiling was pretty low, and at the back of the dance floor, there was a curved railing separating the area with small tables where people could sit and eat. I could picture Lucinda and Charlie there when he was 11 and she was in her mid-20s, that birthday party that they played together. A talkative crowd standing on the wooden dance floor. One of those typical music parties where all the musicians are talking over the playing. Maybe in 1979, when that party happened, Charlie and Lucinda even participated in the inevitable Happy Birthday song. Play that
style. So even back then, she was kind of unique amongst the other songwriters, you're saying?
Of course, she was going to be, she was always going to be unique. There's no doubt that Lucinda was always going to be unique.
And was that because of her voice or her song choice? Like, what was it about her?
Well, of course, she sounds like Lou, but her writing, I mean, and she's like a regional writer in a way. And I always, I mean, I make a comparison to her, which might be unfair to a certain extent, but she's like, you know, the Flannery O'Connor of that era of singer-songwriter, you know, because she, you know, she writes in her little language, you know. Mm.
I think I was reading an interview she did about talking with her dad, and since he was a poet, he really helped her with the editing process of getting that, like, specificity down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think her being and the way she does things, it's so, it's internal and it's for real, and it's something she's sitting with in a room. I mean, great writers don't. I don't think they write the song at the party.
I like that.
Maybe they might leave the party and go back to that whatever that room is, that table that they sit at and sort of like and reflect or feel something. And she just knows how to do that. So she like touches people. That's been going on since probably the first record she made. When people are like, wait a minute, you know, she's got that gift.
I mean, it's. It's interesting because now I've like kind of gone through the whole catalog of her records here, and from like Ramblin' on My Mind, which is those all cover songs, and then she starts introducing her own music, and I feel like I hear over the years her getting closer and closer to her particularity as a writer that like nobody else can replicate that. But you're right in the sense, in the beginning, she had something really special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone, you got to have a perspective on things. Well, everyone has one, but it's a, she's... Lou's feeling a lot of things, you know.
She has that perspective that she's able to, like, verbalize as a songwriter, yeah.
Yeah, she's melodized, verbalized. Oh.
Yeah, it's amazing how unique she sounds, her songwriting is. It's so cool. Like, I've learned so many of her songs now. And even between the songs, they're not too similar, which is cool. It's not like the same thing over and over again. Like, she's not got one pattern that she keeps repeating.
Oh, no, no, Lou has been evolving since, I think, the very beginning, you know. There's an innocent nature to that on the music side of it.
I think about that song Car Wheels, too, like the title track. You know, I listened to it when I was a kid, back when it came out, and then now that I hear it as an adult, it's kind of the story from the perspective of a kid, you know, in the backseat of a car. It kind of seems like maybe there's a conflict amongst the parents. Mm. And I feel like she really gets into that child's perspective.
Yeah.
And almost like opens up memories for everybody, too, that you maybe not even like in touch with totally, you know?
She has the ability. I mean, cause I remember when she was working on that record, because I kind of came into it in the back half of it, I was aware of what was going on the whole time because I'm friends with Steve Earle. Mm-hmm. But she was really, really, really into those. You know, she was drawing a lot of inspiration from certain books and photographs about the Delta and those kind of juke joint kind of things, you know. And that kind of gets, you know, I think she's always had an affinity for that as well. Mm. And that goes back.
In this part of the interview, Charlie talked about how Lucinda drew a lot of inspiration from certain books and photographs. He was referring to the making of her album Car Wheels on a Gravel Road in the late 90s. This was a record that Charlie played guitar on. Specifically, Charlie was talking about the photographs that Lucinda drew from for her song Too Cool to Be Forgotten. Charlie played one of the two guitars on that track. The inspiration for the lyrics and even the title came from a book called Juke Joint by Bernie Iams. It's a series of about 60 photos taken in the mid-1980s. Bernie photographed juke joints, which were a certain type of bar located mostly in the Mississippi Delta. And in one of the photographs in this book, Lucinda must have seen a quote that resonated with her. It showed writing on the wall of one of these juke joints. And it said, quote, "True love, Junebug versus hurricane, too cool to be forgotten." I really love that Lucinda used this wall graffiti from a photograph book for her lyrics. To me, references like that make music so much richer. It's more like eating an omelet with eggs that came from a backyard chicken that's fed kale and peaches, rather than an omelet made of eggs that come in a styrofoam carton from a chicken that's fed conventional grain only. There's depth to it. Now, in terms of books, there's a little bit more to dig into. It's said in one article about Lucinda that she was fascinated by a particular book while making Car Wheels, one that was about Appalachian snake handlers. I couldn't find a specific reference to exactly what that book would have been. But around the time Lucinda was making Car Wheels in the 90s, a book came out that sounds an awful lot like that one. It was called Salvation on Sand Mountain, Snake Handling and Redemption in Southern Appalachia. It seems to me that one of the most important things to understand about Lucinda Williams' songwriting is the literary nature of it. What she sings are not your average lyrics, especially if you think about the stereotypical country song. Lucinda's words are like poetry. The songs are unique in their perspective and their wordsmithing. And so I wondered, what drove Lucinda to bring these literary elements into her writing? Where did she learn to do that? I've answered these questions partially in episode 2, Lucinda's Father's Archives. There I spoke about how writers and artists were a huge part of her community growing up, especially poets and novel writers. But there is a divide between songwriting and poetry, literature and music, something Lucinda has managed to bridge again and again. Interestingly, her father, Miller, who was one of her biggest influences, himself a poet, said that he felt that poetry and songwriting were different things entirely. So, it wasn't her father exactly. There's a particular moment, actually, we can point to where Lucinda found poetry and music coming together. One day, when Lucinda was a kid, a family friend came over to their house. He brought a record that he was really excited to share. He took the vinyl out of a brand new sleeve, and he laid the record down on the player. He lifted the needle and dropped it. Lucinda, at the age of 12, was immediately entranced. The artist she was listening to on this record player was merging poetry with rock music. And the album was Highway 61 Revisited by Bob Dylan. Lucinda learned by listening to Bob Dylan that the world of her father, exquisitely and meaningfully crafted poems and stories, could meld into the music that she also loved. This idea to bring literature and photography and poetry into her music was brought forward to when she wrote the songs on Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. From that day when her family friend brought over Highway 61 Revisited to the day she was sitting in the studio with Charlie Sexton in the late 1990s.
So I'm like curious, in your own personal writing and music, what parts of her music do you think you incorporated in your own style?
I call it the Pandora's box. And I'm nowhere near as prolific as her or a million other people by any means. There was a point. I mean, I moved back to Texas to write because I kind of got stuck in California for about 5 years. I accidentally lived there, and I just couldn't really write there. So I came back here for that reason. And it wasn't because, I need to be next to steel guitars or country bars or, not the cliche aspect of it. People talk about that. Terry Allen talks about it, Lubbock's flat. So there's nothing disrupting your perception of something or you're not, The Pandora's box part is that I had to sit down with somebody that's also a famous songwriter. And he was asking me, he goes, well, I don't understand. How do you do what you do? How do you know about this music? How do you, because I was young when I started. And I kind of gave him the quick, history of my life growing up. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you don't need any more. And it's the same thing an acting coach gave me. He goes, you don't need any more experiences. Mm-hmm. You already got a story. You've got to figure out how to tell that story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean.
Yeah. Was that meeting that I had, he goes, just tell your story. On that page, she really shares her soul with everyone. A lot of people are scared to do that, and that's the Pandora's box. And so that's the way I operate. I believe whatever goes in here stays in there. Whether you believe it, discredit it, or it's in there.
What kind of change in your mind that allowed you to take these experiences and finally express them in lyrics?
It was just a frustration. It's like, I'm tired of, a song can be like a relationship. And at some point it's like, your first date, oh yeah, that's something, a peppy number. And or appetizers and or, oh, movie? Don't have to talk too much. At some point you got to get real.
That's really interesting. Yeah. You kind of grow this relationship with the song where you allow it to develop over time, and it's not just this fun, let's go walk around, the park. It sort of becomes getting real with yourself in this
situation. Songs are weird. I mean, a couple songs I'm talking about, that if I ever got anywhere, 1,000 miles close to what she's capable of doing, it were the songs that were like a Pandora's box. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to tell the story and see if I can make it rhyme when it needs to. The truth usually doesn't rhyme. That's what I always say. But you're not writing a novel or a novelette. You're writing a song. So, but then you got to live with that song. It's the thing. When you, that so easily, I think now more than ever, gets lost on people, that what it takes for any artist, anyone doing something they believe in, that it's attached to film, painting, song, what it takes to actually achieve that thing that makes you maybe take a big breath or a little breath or like like feel it in your core, that costs something to that person. You know what I mean?
This, the creator of that. It costs something to that person. During this interview, I think that this phrase kind of flew past me, whizzed over my head, and flew away. I don't think I really caught the seriousness and depth of Charlie's statement until I listened back later. There's a lot that he was saying when he said that making a work of art costs something to the creator. There's something under that that at the time I don't think I really was ready to hear. I was also fascinated by Charlie's concept of the Pandora's Box. The songs that Lucinda wrote for him were like a Pandora's Box. They lay something out and allow the truth and chaos and stories of an inner world to fly out. And when you set a scene or tell a tale through a song, it ends up being so much more than the sum of its parts. One Pandora's Box-like song for me is Greenville. A particular line. Empty bottles and broken glass, busted down doors and borrowed cash. Borrowed cash, go back to Greenville. How does it, like, change you emotionally, having written that song and finally been able to take the Pandora's Box and make something?
Well, you got, it's a, you know, it's not like Billy Crystal and Analyze This. It's a process. you suddenly, it drudges up all these things. And then if you got to sing it, you kind of got to relive it. But you've brought it to the light, you know. And that's what she does. She brings... And I think that's why she's so powerful at the writing. She will bring things to the light in her own little way. Some of them are heavier than others. But she's also great because she figured out how to just to be poetic, you know. Make people, when they really take the time, it's going to come, it's going to go in there, it's going to stand there, it's going to affect them.
Right. Yeah.
In this interview, I saw how Charlie had a deep, abiding respect for Lucinda as a songwriter. You could tell from the way he spoke about her. Well-researched admiration in his voice. Charlie produced Lucinda's 2001 album Essence. That was her first record after Car Wheels on a Gravel Road came out to rave reviews and changed Lucinda's life. And I wondered, how did making a celebrated, awarded, beloved album changed Lucinda's sense of self-doubt? Was she more confident knowing what she was capable of? Did she finally feel that all the words and music she strained to make work and all the puzzle pieces she matched together was finally paying off? Did she feel more at peace? Did it help with how she saw herself as an artist?
You were kind of talking about the record that you produced with her, Essence, after Car Wheels, and I know that a lot of people, after they make, you know, a record that really resonates with people, and Car Wheels was just such the triumph for her as an artist.
Yeah.
Even if all her other records are really great, too, it was just such a coming together of all the right pieces to make an amazing sound. What was it like emotionally going into the next record? Were there hang-ups about disappointing people or anything like that?
You know, it's Car Wheels was a unique thing because it's like a life artist. They're gonna have that record probably. I mean, mm-hmm. Prine had it at one point. They had it again later. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have it. We're like the songs, the people, the recording, the all the pieces make that one to be special and or unique in its own way. It doesn't discredit the other things. It didn't come easy for her or for anybody involved with it, for the most part, because it was a long process to make Cartwheels. Essence was a different, it was a slower record. It was a more internal, the songs themselves, but they were like, you know, and to be fair, I came in just as she had a concept of what she wanted to do as far as the band for the record. Mm-hmm. So we went to Minneapolis in the summer, into the summer, and started recording for like a week. And then Tony Garnier and I, we left Minneapolis and went on tour. And then she stayed to finish the record. I could see, I could feel what was going on while in that week that we were there. By the time we left, you know, it was, yeah, it was going to be a harder thing to get done than I thought originally imagined by some, which is fine, you know. And that's just, it's not because it needed to be more complicated, just because sometimes it's not ready yet. And then so I went on tour for 2 months, or whatever it was, and then I got a call and said, hey, maybe longer than that. I said, because they've been working the whole time, can you come back and do some guitars? And she may want to recut half the record. There was all these little pieces to it. And then her manager at the time, Frank Galari, he said, come back. Anyway, it was, you know, to get it where she wanted, what she wanted, it wasn't getting there yet. So,
yeah, I mean, it sounds like when you're talking about her songwriting and how much work she puts into it, and then also with her making records, she's not afraid to, like, struggle through producing art, really.
Yeah, because it's not, she's not, she's not making, you know, 5,000 of the same tables to sell on the internet. You know, it's, that's not what she's doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly what you're saying. And that's why it's, she's not making a bunch of mediocre tables to sell. She's making it a deeper, you know, work of art that resonates across generations. That's really why her music and every record you go back to, and it's so wonderful to listen to because it has so much depth to it.
Yeah, I think maybe what she's looking for, you have to ask her, I think she wants that recording to have the truth that she's put into the page. You know what I mean? For her. You know what I mean? It's something that she wants, an essence, for lack of a better say. If you're playing on the stage and you play a song, well, it goes by and it's that, and you remember what you remember about it. Hopefully it's more better moments than not, you know, when you're making a record and it's just sort of like, well, yeah, it's like, I don't recognize that freckle or that, you know, that tooth.
Yeah.
Or like, oh, my eyebrows or whatever, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, thank you so much for being here with us. It means so much. And I think we just have one last question and one final question. No, I guess we're just like curious. So a lot of this whole journey that I'm going on to learn about Lucinda is kind of about my own personal decision about whether to, you know, stay at home and kind of do my other things that I do with farming and stuff, or to, you know, play music and follow in the footsteps of so many amazing musicians. And you know, there's, as you know, like as a musician, you just have so many doubts about your own worthiness in music and that people want you there and that you matter, you know. And I guess, like, just curious to hear about if you've experienced that kind of feeling and how you deal with that.
Huh. Hilarious. You mean, assuming that I wouldn't feel that way?
Oh, I didn't want to
assume. Completely, yeah. No. 100%. And it, the whole artist side of it, or the writing, or what you do, that's really just on the surface of who you are and growing up. And yeah, I mean, we, you know, I think anyone that's any good at what they do, gotta have some low self-esteem somewhere. It was heavily engraved at, you know, at the schoolyard, or if you're lucky, only there. So, Yeah, completely.
It seems crazily obvious now, looking back. But when I asked the question to Charlie in the hole in the wall, if he had self-doubt, it was a genuine question. I was really full of self-doubt, and I assumed that somebody who was as successful as Charlie wouldn't be plagued by that same feeling. I mean, Charlie's played stadiums with what are considered the best musicians in the world. But it turns out that Charlie had self-doubt too, just like me. What Charlie said in the interview made me think that maybe there are a lot of musicians out there playing because they're looking for some affirmation, that they're worth something. Maybe I'm getting a little too psychoanalytical here and making assumptions, but I think that a lot of musicians are up on the stage asking, does anybody care that I'm around? Do I belong?
Yeah. Would you have any interest in playing, want to listen to songs with me?
I could play with I was listening to that song. I barely know that song. I mean, when it came across, I'm like, what is that song? The horrible title. I'm like, oh, I remember this song. You want to play it? I'll play along with you.
Okay.
I get by just fine. Every other day of the week I feel alright. Well, I don't know why. Well, I got to do it. I was so happy that Charlie was willing to play a song with me. I was joyous. And I was surprised at the subtlety of Charlie's guitar playing. I think that sometimes when one pictures the best guitar player around, they think about the style they'd use as being super technical, maybe even really fast. But in fact, the best players fit right into the song, just like Charlie did. I left the hole in the wall and headed back to where I was staying that night, at an Airbnb. There was a pool with a limestone edge. Since it was pretty hot outside, I took off my shoes and my socks and sat down and felt the cool water running over my veins in my feet. I thought over that interview that I had with Charlie, how nervous I was to play with him, to ask him to play with me, tapping my finger on the bar, unsure of how it was going to go, and it ended up good. And I was surprised to learn through the interview that Charlie was not certain of himself at all, and his own music and contributions to others' work. Even though he's amazing, a celebrated musician, he still had doubts. It turns out people who are really successful had similar feelings to what I was having at the time. And I also thought about Charlie's expression of his deep love for Lucinda's songwriting and her music, his description of how oftentimes her songs are like the Pandora's box, and how songs like hers make people stop and feel. I was glad I went down to the hole in the wall. I was glad that I took the risk of doing something outside of my comfort zone, even if I did it all quite nervously. While the interview was great, I didn't exactly get the answers to my questions about Lucinda. about whether she had self-doubt, there was a lot more to be uncovered. I wasn't done in Austin by that point. I had one other place that I wanted to go before I rambled on to some other town. Back when I was deciding where to go on my trip, I was poring through as many obscure Lucinda Williams recordings as I could find. And I came across something that really fascinated me. Something that wasn't out on any official records. Something from 1981 that Lucinda did during a live taping on KUT-FM. She played with a band that she referred to in the recording as Uncle Walt's Band. In this live radio session from 1981, I heard something that fascinated me, an influence that I didn't expect to hear in her music. I knew the influence of country. I knew the influence of the blues to some extent on her writing. But I didn't realize until I listened to this KUT-FM session the influence of something else. Tune in for the next episode of Finding Lucinda, and you'll hear what that was. You can follow along at findinglucinda.com, on social media, or at thebluegrasssituation.com. And if you're really interested in this project and want to learn more about the research behind it, or go even deeper into some of the subject matter discussed, head over to ismaymusic.substack.com. I've written a few articles there where you can find old archival material and more. See you at episode 4.